NYPL Podcasting.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Karen Ciccone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals. It's my real pleasure to welcome you all here tonight on behalf of the New York Public Library. We're thrilled to be hosting Periodically Speaking. This is our fourth year that we've been collaborating. We've had this great collaboration with CLMP, where we're able to showcase literary magazines, provide a venue for writers to read their work, for editors to talk about their journal. We love literary magazines here, and we have a great collection at the library, so I want to encourage you all to come back and visit us or check us out at nypl.org. I want to thank our collaborators at CLMP, Tasha and Jeffrey, for being so great. And I also want to invite you all to stay around after and join us for a reception out in the hall for a glass of wine before we all race off and see what's going on out there. So now I want to introduce Jeffrey Leppendorf, who's the executive director of CLMP, and he's going to introduce tonight's program. Thank you.
And thank you, Karen. Great to see you here tonight on this very auspicious evening. For those listening at home, it's election night, in case you're hearing this on a podcast 4 months from now. This is year four of Periodically Speaking, which is amazing to me. You know, there are probably about 1,000 literary magazines in America as I speak here, and this is our chance to introduce them to you three at a time. So you have to keep coming back to meet all 1,000. And just a quick word about CLMP. The Council of Literary Magazines and Presses has been around since 1967. It was founded to help independent literary publishers through the business of publishing. So we help small publishers through all of the sort of unsexy things, you know, marketing, finding subscribers, and so forth. And occasionally we get to do some things for the public, like this program with the library that allows you to meet not only some wonderful new writers that you may not know yet, but we think you'll be hearing a lot more from in the future, but also get to meet the editors and publishers who allow their work to be known to you tonight. So that's really exciting. We have three great magazines tonight, and unless he has just slipped in, I believe our editor of Many Mountains Moving is, as the name, you're not still moving. He's settled. He has settled into a chair, which is wonderful, so we can do the program as listed. So it's my great pleasure then to introduce Thaddeus Rakowski from Many Mountains Moving. Come on up to the podium.
Yeah, thanks. I'd just like to thank Council Literary Magazines and Presses for having us all here, and thank you all for coming. I know we're not allowed to sell magazines here, but I have one copy of Many Mountains Moving. If anyone wants to look at it, you can look at it. And I also have some flyers for the Many Mountains Moving poetry and flash fiction contests. Just take one if you want. And I just want to tell you about the magazine and the reader. Many Mountains Moving was started in 1994 by Naomi Horry. That's H-O-R-I-I. An activist and community college teacher in Boulder, Colorado. That's where the name comes from. The magazine quickly achieved national recognition by publishing writers such as Allen Ginsberg, Isabel Allende, Robert Bly, and Adrienne Rich. Selections from MMM have appeared in Best American Poetry and the Pushcart Prize Anthology. From the beginning, though, MMM has sought out new and emerging writers. A few years ago, Naomi Horry became ill and had to give up the operation of the magazine. It's now run by a group of editors who are based in various parts of the country and led by Jeffrey Ethan Lee, a professor at Westchester University near Philadelphia. The magazine remains independent. It's not affiliated with any college or university, and the founder, Ms. Horry, still gives advice and sometimes attends events. I became involved with the magazine a few years ago when Jeff Lee asked me to judge the flash fiction contests. I enjoyed doing that, and I'm proud of the winners. One or two of them have done much better than I have. Last year, when one fiction editor left to travel and another fiction editor got a full-time teaching job in Colorado, Jeff asked me to edit both the fiction and the nonfiction sections. The first issue I worked on, the 2007 issue, is out, and selections for the 2008 issue have been made. We're finishing production of 2008 now. My mission and MMM's mission is to publish a diverse group of writers. The idea of diversity applies to culture, gender, geography, and level of recognition. We don't want the work to be limited to any particular trend or style. At the same time, we want to showcase work from groups that are underrepresented in traditional publishing. We look for new writers and edgy writers. In each of the past two issues, there's fiction by someone who's never been published before. The editing process is an inclusive yet selective approach. We've been receiving more than 500 fiction submissions a year and have room for only 7 to 10 of them. Because of that volume, the magazine is closed for general submissions now, and we hope to open the submission site once this year's issue is finished. This evening, I'm glad to be introducing John Swan, a contributor to the 2007 issue. John's story in that issue was about a Manhattan ad man who investigates a series of attacks by a mysterious creature. The animal is incredibly fast and is two-dimensional, like a sheet of paper. Not surprisingly, the beast turns out to be a paper tiger, the type of tiger that might not inhabit our world, but is very much alive in John Swan's world. His main character eventually learns to capture the creature and keep it in a magical origami cage. John has told me he's not going to read Paper Tiger tonight, but the pieces he's chosen aren't so different from that story. All of them concern ordinary people in ordinary settings to whom extraordinary things happen. Most of the settings tend to be suburban and middle American, the kinds of places where Joe the plumber might live. Into these familiar regions, John Swan brings space waves, inner enlightenment, and of course, random acts of sex and violence. His style is spare, minimal, and at times poetic, which means he uses a little to say a lot. And there is always an explanation for what happens, a closure for the pain his characters feel. If the resolution seems simple or unadorned, that may be the point. The activities of life aren't always accompanied by a brass band. But in John's work, grace notes of surprise always accompany the daily rhythms. I'm glad John's part of the Many Mountains Moving community.
I'd like to thank Thad and the New York Public Library and CLMP for giving me the opportunity to read here tonight. My first story is called Transactions. It isn't every day you see a 240-pound woman in a pig mask and a day-glow yellow raincoat robbing a bank, but that's exactly what the pretty young teller at Woodlawn Savings and Loan found herself facing as she looked up from her cash drawer. She started to say next customer, but stopped as she saw who her next customer was. I'd like to make a withdrawal, said Shirley Winterbottom as she handed her red duffel bag to the frightened woman behind the counter, just as she had done the time before and the time before that. And don't even think about hitting the alarm, said Shirley, or I will kill you. The teller looked from the gun to the mask and back again, then quickly filled the duffel bag with cash. When she was done, she gave it back to Shirley, who passed it on to each of the other five tellers. The entire process took two and a half minutes. By the time she was done, the bag contained nearly $10,000. As Shirley turned to leave, she said, "Now could everyone please lie flat on your stomachs on the floor for the next 10 minutes? If you don't wait 10 minutes, I will come back and I will kill you." The sweat stung Shirley's eyes, running down her neck and back as she walked out the door. She imagined herself lying on a tropical beach, sipping a pina colada, as she threw the gun, duffel bag, pig mask, and raincoat in the trunk of her tan Ford Taurus. She grabbed a Snickers bar from the glove compartment and drove away. As always, Shirley found herself humming an Elvis song. Today it was Suspicious Minds. As Shirley turned the corner and headed out of town, she had that strange sense of relief and elation she always experienced right after a job. She rode that high all the way back to her mother's house, where she stashed the money in an old trunk in the attic. Her nest egg was about $60,000 now. She smiled as she closed the trunk, only $40,000 more. Sometimes the smallest event can change the universe. In Shirley's case, it was knowing that the only reason her husband, Mel, would decide that he wanted to do it doggy style with her was if he had already done it that way with somebody else. It was at that moment, when Mel, moaning and panting and sweating, rolled her over onto her stomach in the bed, that she realized what all those long, hard days at the office were really about. Shirley didn't let Mel do it to her doggy style. After that night, Shirley didn't let Mel do it to her at all. She didn't tell him what she thought. She didn't accuse him of anything. She just started sleeping in the spare bedroom. Mel was a little annoyed at first, but after a few days, he seemed to take to this new arrangement just fine. He asked her once or twice what was wrong, but Shirley said nothing. After a while, Mel looked right through her. Maybe that's why Shirley started to eat. She ate anything sweet, ice cream, cookies, pie, cake. But more than anything, she ate Snickers bars, the little ones, the kind kids get in their Halloween bags. She had Snickers bars in the refrigerator, in the bread box, in the kitchen cupboard. She had them in the closet, in the laundry cabinet, in the garage. She had them in her desk, her car, her pockets, her purse. Shirley ate about 50 Snickers bars a day. In a little over 9 months, she gained nearly 100 pounds. It's never easy to be overweight, but if you were, the last place you would want to be is teaching middle school. Kids are cruel. The students in Shirley's 7th grade social studies classes made oinking noises at her and called out, "Suey, suey." They came up with nicknames like Shirley Wide Bottom and clever sayings like, "Shirley's bottom is big enough for winter, spring, summer, and fall." Things finally came to a head that the day Danny Leventhal showed up for class in a rubber pig mask. Shirley took one look at him and started to cry. But she stopped herself. She knew that's what they wanted, to hurt her, to break her down. She confiscated Danny's mask and sent him to the principal's office. Danny's attempted humor earned him a 3-day suspension. The rest of the class considered this punishment grossly unfair. After that, the rude noises stopped, as did the giggles and the hushed conversations and the hastily passed notes. These were replaced by a sullen silence, the same kind of silence that Shirley encountered in the hallways and the teacher's lounge and the faculty lunchroom. It didn't matter. By this point, Shirley hated her students anyway. Sometimes she pictured their sneering faces in the middle of the targets when she went to the shooting range on Saturday mornings. More often, it was Mel's face she pictured, and other parts of his anatomy as well. Her cop father hadn't taught Shirley much, but he had taught her how to handle a pistol. She felt peaceful as she watched shell after shell tear the black hearts out of those little white squares. If Shirley hadn't looked in her purse that June morning and seen Danny Leventhal's pig mask, she might never have started robbing banks in the first place. But Shirley did look in her purse, and she saw that ugly mask, the mask she'd left there for weeks because she couldn't bear to face it, that hideous mask. But now that fleshy pink snout made her smile. She robbed her first bank that same afternoon. She'd have done it that morning, but she wasn't sure what to say to the teller. She rehearsed a speech like the one Brad Pitt taught Gina Davis and Thelma and Louise, but that just didn't seem very original. Instead, she simply walked up to the counter and told the teller she wanted to make a withdrawal. Then, rather than handing her a slip, Shirley held up the gun and handed her the red duffel bag. She told the woman that if she screamed or tried to set off the alarm, she would shoot her. Shirley was surprised at the way the teller's hand shook as she put the money in the bag, the way her lips quivered and her eyes teared up as she handed it back. The same with the other tellers. A few minutes later, Shirley was $9,875 richer. It amazed Shirley how easy robbing banks was. You put on a mask, you walked in, you pulled out a gun, you made a withdrawal. Very simple. Of course, Shirley wasn't stupid. She cased the banks in advance. She avoided places she'd been to before, like Cloverleaf Savings, Union Trust, and the Teachers Credit Union. It wouldn't do to have one of those tellers greet her by name. Still, didn't people plan these things for months? And didn't they still usually end up getting caught? None of it made any sense. Surely Winterbottom was a criminal success story. The first four were a breeze. The tellers were cooperative. The money was good. The getaways were easy. It was like Shirley was invisible. If she took one street, the police seemed to take the other. It was uncanny. The truth is, she never really worked very hard at avoiding capture. Yes, she wore the pig mask and the raincoat, but she drove her Ford Taurus, and she never really planned her escape route. The police couldn't figure it out. An overweight, middle-aged woman, somebody's mother or grandmother. Why would a woman rob a bank? Wasn't that a man's job? Their inability to overcome their initial surprise left them completely unprepared for the idea that this wasn't just a one-time thing. As new reports rolled in week after week, more and more jaws dropped, more and more heads shook. Shirley liked robbing banks. When she was standing there in her pig mask pointing a gun at somebody's head, everything seemed very clear to her. There was a kind of perfect calm. No clothes to wash or meals to cook or floors to sweep or bills to pay. No cheating husbands or disrespectful students. There was nothing but quiet and a sense of complete control. She never talked to anybody about what she was doing. She didn't really talk to anybody anyway but her mother. Actually, that's not right. Shirley didn't talk to her mother. She listened to her because her mother never stopped talking. Never let anyone get a word in edgewise, as she herself would have put it. She never stopped telling Shirley what she should do and what she shouldn't do and what was wrong with what she'd already done. Number five was a mess. No reason, really. A faulty cash drawer. A businessman who wanted to be a hero. It's never just one thing. Robberies are unpredictable, like weather or people. Anyway, Shirley had to use her gun. She fired one shot in the air and put the second one through the hero's briefcase. Shirley was a little startled by how loud the gunshot sounded. At the range, she always wore her earphones. Get on the floor now, or I'll show you what kind of shot I really am. The hero did what he was told, but that started Shirley to thinking what she would have done if he hadn't backed down. Could she have actually shot him, maybe killed him? She didn't know. She'd never even intended to use her gun. She only had it for protection. Yet she hadn't hesitated one bit. Instead, she had done what she needed to do. It was around that time the newspapers started calling her Annie Oakley. That made Shirley laugh. Shooting a briefcase from 20 feet away was nothing. Anybody could do that. That wasn't even shooting. Shirley knew she could easily hit dead center on a target half that size from a distance of 20 yards or more. Which brings us back to the Woodlawn savings and loan. A much easier job, no heroes, no complications, in and out in record time. That evening, Shirley found herself sitting alone watching Jeopardy, a small pile of Snickers wrappers at her feet. Mel was working late again. Shirley didn't care. She'd be leaving him soon. That was the whole point, to save enough money that she could pack her bags and go. She wanted him to come home to an empty house, an empty table, an empty bed. Not that he would care. In fact, maybe that was what he really wanted. Fine, she would let him have it. A few days later, Shirley was back on the job. This time she hit Franklin Trust. Once again, she did nearly everything right. She got in and out of the bank quickly. She got away without being seen. She drove calmly and carefully. She avoided the main roads. The cops stopped her because her left taillight was out. It was only when he approached the car and noticed the small triangle of fluorescent yellow fabric sticking out of Shirley's trunk that he became suspicious. He didn't take any chances. He called for backup right away. Before Shirley knew it, she was surrounded by half the police cars in the county. Everyone was surprised it was Shirley, her mother, her students, her fellow teachers. But the most surprised person of all was Mel Winterbottom. He couldn't believe his eyes when he saw his wife on the 11 o'clock news. One of the sheriff's deputies asked Shirley what made her rob banks. The money, she said. I did it for the money. Then she told them about the shooting range and the earplugs and those targets with the little black hearts. She told them about Danny Leventhal and the pig mask and how he shouldn't have been putting it on in class. She told them other things, too, like how her mother never listened and how none of her pretty dresses fit anymore, and how her husband Mel tried to do it to her doggy style. That's when she looked down at her hands, which were holding on to each other for dear life. I had to do something with that gun. I figured robbery was better than murder. After that, Shirley stared at her hands for a long time. Finally, she lifted her head up, took a long, slow breath, and started to hum Heartbreak Hotel. This story is called Wendell on the Lawn. Wendell was out there again, standing on the lawn. Every day it was the same thing. Other kids walked to the corner to meet their buses. Wendell walked halfway across the yard and stopped. That was as far as he ever got. Buses came and went, people came and went, time came and went. Wendell never moved. It's weird how quickly things can change. One day Wendell was laughing and playing. The next he was just standing there. It was like his batteries ran down or someone flipped a switch and turned him off. Wendell's parents tried everything. They took him to doctors. They took him to hospitals. They took him to shrinks. Nothing helped. Then it started happening to other kids. That's when people started calling Wendell's house and hanging up. That's when they put the for sale signs in Wendell's parents' yard. It's when they chucked a brick through the front window. The local media had a field day. Their headlines joked about the town coming to a standstill. But it wasn't amusing for long. It was Stanley Lieberman who first noticed that it was all boys. Stanley had a personal stake in the matter. His son Ben was one of them. There was a lot of fear, of course. People thought the boys were zombies or vampires or something. It wasn't long before the story drew national attention. Soon the streets filled with a cavalcade of buses and vans and limos. It seemed like everyone had a camera. No one knew what to do. No one knew what to say. No one wanted to stare, but they couldn't help themselves. No one wanted to acknowledge that the boys' numbers were growing. Everybody had a theory. Some said it was mass hypnosis. Others said catatonia or sleeping sickness. Still others said the boys were faking it. Everyone agreed something had to be done. Then the Andrews boy got struck by lightning. They said his hair burned like the head of a match. He never screamed. He never ran. He never fell. He just stood there until his skin turned black and shiny. That's when the government got involved. They sent in a team of medical experts. They thought if they could figure out what happened to Wendell, they could figure out what happened to the rest of them. They gave him blood tests and urine tests and IQ tests, and all turned out normal. People were disappointed. They needed someone to blame for all of this. It was frustrating to discover that Wendell wasn't a monster. He was just a kid. A Hollywood director visited the town. He said he was thinking of making a movie about Wendell. He said the working title was Wendell on the Lawn. He described it as a modern-day fable. Some reggae band made a song. It was called The Boy Who Stopped By. They swore it wasn't based on Wendell. Bullshit, the mayor said. The town council was at the end of its rope when it passed the new ordinance. It said that all inanimates, which is what they were calling kids like Wendell, were to be kept out of sight during the day. Any violation of this ordinance could result in a fine or even jail time. Parents started locking children in their rooms. For about a week, Wendell stayed inside. Then his parents broke down and unbarred the door. People were angry when they saw Wendell. They yelled and pointed at him. Wendell just stood there. The town council warned Wendell's parents. "You do something about him or we will," they said. Wendell's parents agreed to disagree. The supervisor called the police chief, who called the mayor. Plans were made to meet at Wendell's house the next day. The plan turned out to be unnecessary. Wendell and all the rest of them disappeared that night. Everyone was sleeping soundly but the children. They looked out their windows and saw the boys floating in the sky on beams of light. All they did was smile. I'm just going to read a couple more short pieces. This is called Goldie and Me. I noticed my goldfish was hardly moving the other day, so I took off my shoes and dove in the bowl with her. Her eyes got real big when she saw me sitting on the rock. I talked to her in bubble language and said it would be okay. She kissed me hard with those big orange lips of hers. I played hide and seek in the coral. She pretended not to see. Later, when I was doing my stupid science homework, she kept smiling and making kiss prints on the glass. I wanted to jump back in the bowl, but it was dinner time. My mother served us something totally new that night. She said it was macaroni casserole, but I had my doubts. Sometime later, I moved out and went away to college. This is called Supersonic. My mother speaks a language that I don't understand. She smiles that secret smile of hers and says, "Gabiella Fersh." I smile back and try to look like I know what she's talking about. "Sweep Krish Kafofnium," she says as she rocks back and forth. I try to use my powers to beam thoughts directly to her brain. She points to herself and says, "Blamedly Flamsongul." I wrap my arms around her and tell her everything is okay. The nurse comes and tells me my mother needs to get her rest. I fly around the city and think of all the things I could smash. Instead, I sit atop the Chrysler Building eating a power bar. Somewhere nearby, a nail gun is being fired again and again. It sounds to me like pachu, pachu, pachu. Thank you.
Thank you, John. The best place, of course, if you're in New York, to discover new lit mags is here at the library. And if you do find one that seems to speak to you, I highly recommend you subscribe to it. The fact is, the only way that a magazine can really survive is if it has subscribers. It might surprise a lot of you to know that if you buy a magazine on a newsstand, the cost of that magazine doesn't begin to cover what it actually costs. So it really requires people to sustain supporting a magazine to keep them going. So please do support the ones you like so that they can keep giving you what you like. And now for a poetry selection, let me call up Levi Rubeck from Washington Square.
First off, I would also like to thank the New York Public Library, as well as Tasha at CLMP and April Heck from NYU, who helped get Washington Square involved with this. As the student-run literary journal of NYU, Washington Square goes through a complete editorial realignment every school year. Obviously, aesthetic tastes shift, and the writers we desire to work with rotate, but there are a few things that are standard from year to year, including an energetic focus on translation. We student writers and lifetime readers agree on Washington Square's mission of publishing literary translations of works from around the world and the dialogue inherent between author and translator. We also emphasize printing the piece in its original language side by side with the translation so that one can see, if not totally understand, the changes taking place as the work moves from one tongue to the next. When asked to choose a reader for the periodically speaking event, I first thought of this dedication to translation and the plight of the author-translator. Speaking only fragments of other languages, I can barely imagine what it's like to get lost in one set of words used by a poet, and then the pressure of correlating those to a separate lexicon, struggling to maintain the beauty, wit, fury, etc., across linguistic barriers, while balancing the meaning, playfulness, and intent of the original author, all of which is done through the translator's own mental filter. The challenges of removing the self from this sort of work are nearly impossible to avoid while staying true to the translation, an already grueling procedure. Now imagine these conditions piled on top of one's own struggle with his or her writing. It's a lot to comprehend, which is why I'm happy to read translators such as Elisa Gabbert, who make the whole process seem easy. Elisa translated César Vallejo's El Momento Más Grave de la Vida for Washington Square, but she's definitely a poet in her own right. I bought her chapbook, Thanks for Sending the Engine, at the AWP Book Fair, hoping only that I didn't waste my $5. Luckily, the chapbook became one of my prize snags from the entire conference. It's one of those books that, at first, made me jealous that one poet could write such fantastic, slippery poems on a daily basis as part of a blogging challenge, but jealousy quickly turned to admiration. The poems have that misleading whimsicality that comes from many poet translators. There must be something about a deep immersion in all manner of syllables and not quite synonyms that takes the fear away from Elisa, allowing her to write not only about the big stuff, ornithology, violence, meaninglessness of life, but also to talk about email, video games, and her ability to cook frittatas. It is exactly this freedom, this open-mindedness, which best serves both translators and poets, because one cannot be locked into a single idea of what poetry is and still expect it to communicate the incommunicable. Poetic limitations do not allow a translator to take one person's epiphany, switch the vocabulary, and expect to maintain that epiphany easily. It is that kind of line-by-line revelation that Elisa brings to both her translations and her own poems, the kind of thing that John Yao or Lynn Hejinian would pull, letting meaning sip in word by word. While reading her poems, I am constantly thinking, yes, exactly, this is how it is, while admitting I'm not really sure what the it is. Because when we figure out the mystery, it dissipates along with the passion for the answers. But reading a poet who works so well with language we use every day refreshes me. Elisa can make any comparison into a poetic discourse. She reminds us that nothing is outside of the bounds of poetry, that daily is everything, and everything is sacred, therefore it all has the potential to be poetry. She has helped me, at least, expand my own language and ideas of what constitutes verse. To the poet translator, there is much to enjoy beyond a single language lifestyle and its limited diction, and I, for one, cannot wait to see what Elisa comes up with next in either capacity. Elisa Gabbert's recent poems appear or are forthcoming in Colorado Review, Diagram, 1111, Jubilat, Pleiades, and other journals. She is the author of the chapbook Thanks for Sending the Engine, as well as two collaborative works co-written with Kathleen Rooney, Something Really Wonderful and That Tiny Insane Voluptuousness. Please welcome Elisa Gabbert.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to Levi. That introduction was really incredible. It made me nervous. I'm not reading translations tonight, so I hope nobody came specifically hoping to hear those. I used to always be really freaked out about the idea of translating. It just seemed impossible. And then I just kind of decided that it was more important to have a poetic sensibility than to be fluent in a language. And I just kind of took a stab at it. And it's really fun. So if anybody is afraid, I encourage you to try it. This first one's called Poem with a Threat. Columning storm cloud, gnatch, dead bird. My fear of X is worse than X, more scary. What am I wearing? The less I recognize myself, the less I contradict, scratch, feel contrary to my mirror image in the pool of grief down there. No one would ever say that, but I might say puddle of despair. I was just telling my friends Jared and Farah yesterday, they gave me a ride here, about how I hate how there are certain words that are only used in poems, I think. Like, people would use stone in a poem instead of rock. And that's kind of like pool versus puddle. Near life experience. Weird. I almost died. Don't touch my pivot point, my cicatrix. It prickles me. My center of gravity, my weak spot for mortality. Where they held me when I got dipped. If you think about it, you can figure out what groups of animals are called. A smear of snails, a misery of pigeons. I almost slipped on this almost bird, fallen to the earth like a ruined, a baby blue breakfast. Abundant sunshine. The mica sparkles through him, her, it. Walks are useless too. And this is after my friend Chris Tinelli, poet Chris Tinelli, who has a poem called Walks Are Useless. There's nothing to be sad about. My sadness grows restless, nostalgic for a better bore. The tragic bore of yesteryear. The stink of the city grows worse, but at the same rate that we get used to it. 'Tis a bore and nothing more. Even the clouds are bored, arrange themselves into more and more exotic vegetables. Where is the war? I can't see it. I feel incredible. What I mean is, I feel like no one would believe me. This next one is from my chapbook, Thanks for Sending the Engine, and it was part of the NaPoWriMo project, where all these poets kind of sign up to write a poem every day for the month of April. You know, there's one for novels too. I think it's actually this month, right? Fictionaries. Yeah, and a lot of poets I know will then post the poems on their blogs. And so I called my poems blog poems. This one's called Blog Poem for April. You can't invent a color, only name it. Like how I just named those contrails Benjamin, and then the sky behind them, Benjamin the Second. Now, retronymically, I refer to Ben as Ben One. If he becomes famous, they'll stop calling clouds clouds and call them nonlinear clouds, or pre-Benjamin for clarity. I can think about fame all day and compose apologies for my friends' friends, whom I variously snubbed, write them into emails with personalized PSs. P.S. My love for you extends forever in all directions, or sometimes seems to. P.S. I include a swatch of Yves Klein blue. P.S. If the sky is a piano store and clouds are baby grands, we just hang out in the back and listen to Acacio tones pre-programs. P.S. This P.S. is my email's last will and testament. It's leaving everything to you. P.S. Like my love for you, like the infinite crystalline watch face of God of the sky, my email will never die. Ego of the distance. Mystery distance, resistant distance. It glimmers out of visibility. The distance that runs seemingly along all my images like a fold. Like a hairline crack down my mirror. I am always looking at the distance, at it splitting me. I am warped along that fault. Sometimes the distance looks at me, and for a moment I feel requited. But then the distance rushes away at impossible speeds, like the other side of the balloon, the other end of the expanding universe. It doesn't remember when we were touching, eye to eye, or just doesn't fetishize that time like I do. I call out after the distance, "Is it me?" The distance responds with Doppler effect. It's me. I had this ex who we had this thing where we would always try to touch eyes. Like we'd try to not blink and get really close. So our eyes would touch, but we could never do it. It's like this impossible feat. This is another blog poem. It's called Lousy Day Blog Poem. Am I breathing too hard into the microphone or anything? Sometimes I do that. Okay. Lousy Day Blog Poem. Was the end of a lousy day. Drank too much and everyone agreed my emotions were implausible. Once again, I couldn't prove the theorem. Once again, I had no love for anyone or vice versa. Anyone had no love for me. There was no art on the train, and then it never came. Made me late for my appointment with the firing squad, my last disappointment. Day was a wash, but its poem was a sidekick that tried to cheer it up. The day rode along, mostly lost in thought, and the traffic had died out for the most part. And the poem was the day's faithful sidecar, stuck around to listen to the fusillade. This one's called Poem with Intrinsic Music. And I mean that in the filmic sense, music that comes from within the scene that's happening rather than imposed upon it. When there's classical music playing during a battle scene, that's extrinsic music. It's not really like if there's an orchestra there. You know what I'm saying? Empty tennis courts of autumn, the landscape wants to appropriate you like fallow cortex, the brain overturning itself. A blind woman has no use for sports, but the cells could go to memorizing Bach, the cello suites, the overtures. This one's like tipping your head back to take in the sky gone shallow, dimensionless, shot with no timestamp, the rule of threes, seesaw, seesaw. One is like dust, cricket legs, wings. Another, approaching the tree line to find they're not far away, just very small trees. Do you guys say obad or obeyed? Obad? Okay. Not really sure. This is my first obad. We both dream about wild animals. There had been a dog fight at the party. The older, bigger dog somehow threatened by the puppy, a girl. He was chasing her in circles around the yard, knocking over drinks and gnawing on her leg. I tensed when they bumped against mine, and you said not to be afraid of them. They're only dogs. A rash prickled up there, and I scratched it all night. The birds screech outside at this bleak hour. Why do they always sound terrorized? It's a wave. Their cries, the encroaching light, the room growing paler in pin dots, coming up to our edges, us feeling separate. The nightmare you gave me, or caught. Has anybody been timing me? I'm really bad at this. Let's skip a couple. This one's called I Even Feel Tired in My Dreams. I have to finish the tennis match, but I just want to sleep. Small dogs leap up and latch onto my arms. I just realized I read two dog poems in a row. I'm allergic to dogs, like, I'm kind of afraid of them. And I really do have nightmares about them all the time. Small dogs leap up and latch onto my arms. I want to lie down, let them have me. But if I die before my mom, she'll never forgive me. I can see my pulse pounding right through the skin. How minor can a heart attack be? Can you have one in your sleep and not die or even start? Just sleep right through it like a too soft alarm. Ee. Well, that sounds really good in the mic. I often smoke in my dreams. Am a dancer. Eat meat. Every heartbeat is a minor attack. An army inside me is waging a war of attrition. How many blips make an army? Tiny brute-hearted army. The faster your metabolism, the shorter your lifespan. I'm down there with lab mice. I empathize completely. Concordance, right through, as in a trap door. My mom is going to die. The word lupus means wolf. Most commonly named wish that is also a fear, to die in one's sleep. I get emotive on planes. A stab of joy during the movie, or simple pain, I cried. The ignoble cry of the anonymous passenger. It's not a scene if everyone ignores it, my quivering eye. Self-sabotage at this point would be suicide. X-ray outline of somebody's penknife, I saw a picture of John's hand on the back of my head. Always in joy, I am parallel to a suffering out there, a bad front. When I said, the clouds feel like nothing when you're in them, he said, no, they feel like frozen fog. Confusing feeling with seeming, I think, and nothing and suffering with fog. Decoherence. In my sex dream come anxiety dream, my ex decides at the last minute he's not interested in giving me another chance. My current bedroom, where he's never been, the light black and blue like night on film. A dream of the future, blaring the past. Fear of missing out or fear of not knowing. Variations on the same theme. He was doing this quantum thing every time I looked away, half in the bed and half leaving, knowing I'd revert to my one-note innocence. I keep thinking about a woman I met. One day, approaching an intersection, she was afraid she wouldn't be able to stop walking. I just have a couple more. Screenshot for Alan. Here's you. Here's your street. Now zoom out, way out. That speck on the right-hand side by the scroll bar is me. Hanging on the coast, hiking around in the cold day air, cerulean wind whipping at our faces with our own hair. Over the dunes, always more dunes. You would have said, why does it have to be so sandy? Since you weren't there, I said it instead. I wonder what you were doing then. Probably writing out equations on unlined paper in your fast, loopy hand. Something I couldn't comment on, except at this superficial level. How stupid of me to find your pencil marks sexy. To prefer them to the world, the huge freezing ocean. It does nothing for me. This gull wing jutting up out of the sand. Is there a bird down there, objecting, politely? Excuse me, world, I wasn't ready to be buried. The dream because love ends. The person I'm playing tennis with keeps changing back and forth between my brother and my ex-boyfriend. I hope this means nothing. I just miss them both. They make me feel fucking horrible. Some part of me knows it's 4 a.m. and I'm too weak to dive for a shot. My racket strings are on the verge of snapping gloriously like Achilles tendons. Alan wears the face from when we went apt hunting, and he called all the places in our price range Calcutta. As soon as I think of that, flying roaches enter from the west. My brother whacks at them with his old Wilson as they whiz by our ears at their disgusting frequencies, speed skating black figure eights against the dusty sky. We make a run for the pro shop, and soon enough, we're drinking orange soda on the couch like everything is okay. Alan drapes one of his long arms, his Hong Kong brown arms, piano hand arms, road hockey scarred elbow arms across my shoulder, and says that everything is okay. On TV, they're showing footage from the courts, and it seems like we're still out there, man versus nature. I wonder out loud if it's some kind of joke, and one of them says, if it is, it's the saddest, the longest, the slowest, most beautiful joke you could tell. He doubles me over. He knows me so well. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. I want to quickly thank A couple of our funders who helped make this series possible for you, namely the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. I also want to point out that in front of you there are pygmy pencils, little tiny pencils, which are your keepsake, souvenir keepsake of this evening. If you like, please feel free to take them home, write your own poetry, creative nonfiction, or fiction, and perhaps mail it in to one of the fine magazines presented to you tonight. Or, and perhaps also, do take a moment before you leave tonight to fill out the little survey form in front of you. What you get out of tonight's presentation, of course, is wonderful writers representing fantastic magazines reading to you in a very glamorous space. And what our funders get out of tonight's evening are those pieces of paper sent back to them so that they feel like they've invested wisely, which we think they have. Hopefully you agree. And now, last but not least, from Bidoun editor Michael Vasquez.
This is going to be a bigger issue for Onnit, I think, but or maybe it's fine. Thank you to everybody, the library, and the CLMP, and this room is such a great, amazing room, even to just listen to something in. So, Bidoun, or Bidoun, means without in Arabic and Farsi. It was founded in 2004 by Lisa Farjam as a platform for thinking about and sometimes making art and culture in and from the Middle East. 4 years and 15 issues later, Bidoun has a team of editors based in Dubai, Cairo, and Beirut, as well as mostly New York. One part of our mission is to document, critique, and perhaps shape debates and careers of artists from the region. And to that end, each issue has reviews and previews of exhibitions, profiles of artists, treatments of works in progress, and artist projects. Another increasing part of our mission is to provide a forum for gonzo journalism, literary essays, and other forms of creative nonfiction. So our current issue, for example, on the theme of pulp, which is not available for sale here, but which you can find online, or browse at the end of the table, I think, features the true story of a Pakistani gourmet ice cream mogul who plowed his profits into horror films, a pilgrimage to the Georgian home of the 1980s Iranian wrestler, the Iron Sheikh, or Sheikh, sorry, and a reminiscence of the Nirvana-driven Satanism outbreak in 1990s Beirut, and also the latest installment of Anand Balakrishnan's Egyptian Dispatches. Anand lived in Cairo a few years ago, after interning at Transition, the journal I was editing at the time, which is sort of to Africa as Bidoun is to the Middle East. He would send me the most fantastically disturbed emails, lurid accounts of articles he was going to write, of terrifying or amazing people he had met, including the God-hating metalhead kid who learned to speak English by listening to Metallica cassettes. Then he came back to America and went to law school, where he still resides, and I feared these stories might be lost forever. Luckily, I have managed to wrangle a few of them out of him for Bidoun, including the lead story in our special issue on failure, which strangely is on display back there, and the epic adventure of his encounter with Naguib Mahfouz's white linen suit in our objects issue, which is also, I don't know why I'm shilling so much, but we have a copy back there that you can see. Tonight, also, finally, on the theme of subscribing, there are cards that you can subscribe with at the end of this table. But tonight, he is reading from his story in our current issue, The Toughest Man in Cairo versus the Zionist Vegetable.
Good evening. Raise your hand if you can't hear me. You can't? Or you? Okay, thanks. So thanks to the library and to everyone who put this together. So this story, as Mike just said, is called The Toughest Man in Cairo versus the Zionist Vegetable. I'm going to read from the first half of the first half, which makes it the first quarter. All right. According to... Please.
According to my old neighbor, Kamal Hanafi, the vegetables in Israel are huge and good for only one thing. The cucumbers, he explained, eyes lighting up, are this long. He stretched his hands more than a foot apart. They are this wide. He made a circle with his two hands, and they taste like shit. All chemicals and unnatural fertilizers. He spat. No one can eat vegetables that disgusting. The only people who use them are the women, who sit like this. He spread his legs to demonstrate. And the men, of course. The invisible cucumber in his hands jabbed sharply up, and now they're sending their vegetables to Egypt to fuck us all. Kamal could see it, a flood of Israeli vegetables inundating the Egyptian market, washing away the old dream of agricultural self-sufficiency. More pernicious still, the image of oversized Zionist produce coming for his two young daughters. Kamal was very concerned with what his children put in their mouths. It is difficult to keep them pure, he complained, before listing the few shops that still sold untainted greens from Umm al-Dunya. But it wasn't just the vegetables. In the years since Sadat's policy of Infatah liberalized the Egyptian economy, delectable imports have come dancing through the open door to tempt the girls of Egypt. It began with foreign banks, foreign aid, and joint ventures with Xerox, Colgate-Palmolive, and Ford. And it culminated with a torrent of chocolate from Hershey's and Nestle, as well as Dove bars, Lay's potato chips, Pepsi, Diet Pepsi, acid-wash jeans, waffles, bikinis, rap music, exercise videos, Britney Spears, and lesbianism. If he had a son, things would be easier. But Kamal has not been so lucky. He's been trying to have a son for years. He tries every night, he told me, but all his wife has given him are girls he will one day lose to a wet t-shirt contest and the all-you-can-eat breakfast buffet in Sharm el-Sheikh. My friendship with the Hanafi family was my proudest accomplishment in Cairo. Kamal, his wife, and his two daughters live just down the hall in my building, a not-so-solidly middle-class apartment complex in Sayyida Zainab. Kamal was an old friend of my Arabic teacher, and soon after I moved in, I began an aggressive charm offensive. In the afternoons, I came back from my job editing English translations and stopped by their apartment for tea, practicing my Arabic with Kamal while the two girls practiced their English with me. I made a point of bringing them tasteful and conservative gifts, Egyptian-made, of course, colored pencils, expensive stationery, pale white dolls with long, knotty hair and ugly lace dresses. I sat with Kamal day after day and held my chin thoughtfully through long lectures on the dangers of foreign involvement in Middle Eastern affairs. One day, after polishing off a plate of kunifa, I criticized the idea of U.S. intervention in Darfur. It is an Arab problem, I said, and the Arab League can solve it. The United States is treating Sudan like Iraq, a staging ground for imperial expansion. Kamal nodded, gazing approvingly at me through his large square bifocals. From then on, he had his daughters refer to me as uncle. I had succeeded. I had friends. My conquest was not complete, however. I could not, and never would, win over Kamal's wife. Rania taught literature in an adjunct capacity at one of the universities in town. I would ask her about Arabic literature and poetry, about her classes, her family, politics, movies. She was never anything but cordial, but there was something about the perfunctory way she answered my questions that made me think she was wary of my presence. She had cause to be wary. Soon after he declared me an honorary Arab, Kamal embarked on a courtship of his own. It began with a series of quiet taps on my door. It must have been sometime after 2 a.m, and I was lying in bed, neither awake nor asleep, paralyzed by the heat and a nameless anxiety. The taps sounded like Morse code. An SOS? I tiptoed to the door and looked through the peephole. I saw Kamal's face, stretched and distorted, peering back at me. I opened the door. Kamal was wearing his pajamas. He was barefoot. And he was holding a trembling pack of Cleopatra Superlux. Super, because they came in an extra wide hard pack. Lux, because they were extra long. I asked him if something was wrong. He shook his head. No. I asked him if he wanted to come in. He did. He showed himself to my couch and sat down, placing the pack of cigarettes on the coffee table. He had something to ask me, he said, and he didn't want me to take it the wrong way. He wanted me to blow smoke in his face. I looked at the cigarettes and hesitated. It was an odd request. I didn't smoke. Even in Cairo, where everybody smoked, I had only ever gone in for melon-flavored shisha, and even then I hadn't even really inhaled, secreting the perfumed smoke in my cheek. I explained this to him, slightly chagrined. But he wasn't asking me to smoke. He used to smoke 2 packs a day, he said, back before he got married, but his wife had made him promise to quit, and he had. But he still liked the smell, and I wouldn't have to inhale. He looked very innocent on the couch, with his thick bifocals and his pajamas and his black dress socks, and I didn't mind the smell of smoke, so I agreed. I sat on the couch with Kamal and tore the plastic off the cigarette pack. The couch was a gift from my boss, an ancient Leonine woman who had grown up in the days of King Farouk, drank gin straight, and muttered angrily at her breath at the sight of mahajabas. She must have been very fashionable in her 20s, which is when she bought the couch. It was faux French, with dark green fabric and a paisley pattern. There were cherubic faces on the wooden backrest, carved in bas relief, blowing whirls of wind from pursed lips. Over the decades, a rusty spring had cut its way through the center of the couch. 6 inches of jagged metal wobbled between Kamal and me. I've never been very good with matches, I'm afraid, and I had trouble lighting the cigarette. Each failed attempt added a small mountain of matches on the table and a stench of sulfur in the air. Finally, it caught. The cigarette flared as the paper started to burn, and I carefully drew a cloud of smoke into my mouth. I held my breath and leaned in over the paisley print and the exposed spring within inches of Kamal's expectant face. He had removed his glasses for the occasion. I could see the pores on his skin, the light razor burn on his left cheek, the mustard-colored stains on his incisors, a testament to years of heavy smoking and poor oral hygiene. I thought he would close his eyes, or at least look away. But he stared right at me. I noticed for the first time that his light brown irises were speckled with flecks of gold. Then I exhaled, releasing a stream of smoke that traveled in a long, unbroken line before curling up into his nostrils. The scent of his cologne mixed with the bitterness of the tobacco. Kamal threw his head back, his eyelids fluttered, his upper lip quivered, and his cheek hollowed as he sucked away in my direction. Somehow I had not noticed the awkwardness of the whole scene until that very moment. I busied myself with the cigarette and the ashtray in an attempt to hide the mixture of embarrassment and amusement I felt at Kamal's evident pleasure. After I'd stubbed out what remained of the cigarette, Kamal relaxed into the couch. He spoke wistfully about his life before Rania, when he'd spent nearly all his time chain-smoking with his old friend Wagdi Lewis. If smoke represented freedom, Wagdi and Kamal had spent the 1980s liberating Egypt. Kamal chuckled as he described the quantities of tobacco they burned, fields of tobacco as wide as the Sahara and as tall as the pyramids. It wasn't just cigarettes, though. There was modest amounts of alcohol as well, and some, wink, wink, hashish. And there were politics. Wagdi was a secular leftist and so deeply principled as to exert a gravitational force on those around him. He easily indoctrinated Kamal, who recounted with pride tales of Wagdi's struggle with the corrupt Egyptian government and its foreign backers. Unlike Kamal, who retreated into a stultifying world of domesticity, Wagdi remained politically engaged. Even after starting a family, he had spent 5 years in prison for attempting to stockpile explosives. Wagdi had changed in only one way. He'd quit smoking. Not because anyone told him to, but because even homegrown Cleopatras were no longer 100% Egyptian. In Kamal's Egypt, there were 4 types of men. There were the men over 50 who were castrated by the events of 1967, and those under 30 who suckled on the weak milk of Lebanese music videos. Between them was Kamal's own generation, men who had seceded from society to create inviolable nation-states of their families. And then there was Wagdi, a category unto himself, the toughest man in Cairo, a superman who did not know the meaning of the word defeat. The night ended as abruptly as it began. Kamal issued a brief but vitriolic attack on USAID. He made fun of my sneakers. He looked around the living room of my apartment and told me I needed a woman to take care of me. Then he stood up, thanked me for my hospitality, and tiptoed down the hallway to his wife and daughters. Our secret relationship went on like this for months. The nocturnal visitations, the secondhand smoke, the stories about Wagdi. Every few days, at one or another inappropriate hour, Kamal would knock softly but insistently until I woke up and let him in. Sometimes I tried to stay up to wait for him, but his comings were unpredictable. He would probably have come every night if he could have, but he had a whole series of deliberate precautions designed to hide his perfidy from his family, and after a while I just accepted it. I still stopped by Kamal's apartment after work sometimes, but less than before. I resented the pretense, the highly mannered welcome Rania gave me when I came in, the hungry look in Kamal's eyes when I left. One afternoon, I stopped by the Hanafis to drop off a plate of sweets my coworker had given me. It was more than I could eat myself. The door was open, and I stood at the entrance for a moment without announcing myself. Kamal and Rania were having an argument. She wasn't blind to Kamal's indiscretions. "Admit it," I heard her saying. "You've been smoking again. I can tell. You can go out at all hours of the morning and then come back sneaking home, washing your hair in the dark." "It's the foreigner who smokes," Kamal said. His voice sounded desperate. "He is Hindu, from America. They have terrible habits." And then, self-righteously, "I have never smoked." "This is just like the Wagdi situation. Your friends are a terrible influence on you, but I stopped seeing Wagdi, and you will stop seeing this man too. But he is a foreigner. He has no family, no friends. He is not to come into our house. Darling, don't do this," Kamal pled. I couldn't take it anymore. I left the sweets by the door and crept away, feeling sick to my stomach. I was the bad influence? 2 months into our relationship, I'd become an addict. I had begun to smoke on my own, squirreling away a pack of Marlboro Reds in my bedroom where Kamal wouldn't find them. I had started inhaling. And I didn't have many friends, actually, but I didn't need to hear about it from Kamal, and I certainly didn't need his pity. A week later, I heard the familiar tap, tap, tap on my door. I lay in bed, ignoring it, hoping he would go away. But he kept drumming his fingers, and despite myself, I let him in and once more acted out the ritual. Looking nervous, he asked where I'd been, why I hadn't come by his apartment. I told him I'd been busy. I couldn't bring myself to tell him I'd overheard their conversation, and he couldn't bring himself to tell me not to come by. We had achieved a kind of equilibrium. I mostly stopped listening to the stories he told, chain-smoking the time away till he was done. His visits became less frequent. His precautions had become still more elaborate, I guess. One night, Kamal appeared at my door in a state of extraordinary agitation. I was already smoking. In fact, I was marinating in smoke. He sat down next to me. "My wife is leaving tomorrow," he said. "She was going to Beni Suif to visit her family." "Freedom," he sighed. Then he leaned across the metal spring and put his hand on my arm. "I need your help," he said, his voice dropping conspiratorially. "Sure," I responded. I was mesmerized by the smoke's languorous ascent through the air to my ceiling. My dignity and I had parted ways some time ago. I probably would have agreed to anything. He had made plans to see his old friend Wagdi, the toughest man in Cairo, remember? I nodded. It was to be a reunion of sorts. "He wished I could meet him," he said, "but it was not in my destiny. I had my own, very important role to play. He needed me to watch his daughters while he was out." I saw it all in my mind right then, the whole arc of our relationship. My courtship of Kamal and his family. Kamal's courtship of me. Kamal's betrayal of me. And now, suddenly, my betrayal of Kamal. My hand shook. "They can stay in my apartment," I promised, hoping my voice did not betray my excitement. "It will give me great pleasure to welcome your daughters," I said in exceedingly formal Arabic. I'm now going to skip forward to another section. Or should I keep going from there? Keep going? Okay. Thanks. It is election night. When he left my apartment, I lay in bed, sweating through my sheets. It was a hot night, and it was almost impossible to sleep. I lit cigarette after cigarette and stared at the light cast on my ceiling by the street lamps outside. I woke up, covered in ash. My recollection of the next day is hazy, filtered as it is through my guilty conscience. I remember running to the corner store and the look on the cashier's face at the sum I spent. I remember slowing my sprint to a walk when I passed a security officer, as though he could see my intentions, or worse, what was in the bags I was carrying. I remember closing my curtains because the sunlight hurt my eyes. And I remember hearing Kamal's familiar knock at an unfamiliar time of day. He stood in the hallway, dressed in a suit, with his hands on his daughter's heads. "Good morning," he said, beaming. The girls must have sensed something was wrong. They looked into my dark, drab apartment with trepidation. Kamal was oblivious. "Go on, my ladies. Uncle will take care of you today." He noticed the cigarette in my fingers and said something vaguely disapproving, but he hurried away with a wave before I could respond. The girls filed in, reluctantly. I should say that my intentions were not evil. I did not intend to hurt the girls. They were merely pawns in a game their father had set in motion. I swallowed hard. "Sit down over there," I said, gesturing towards the couch with my cigarette hand. I told them not to be frightened, that we were going to have a special English lesson, that we were going to have a good time together. Ash fell on the floor as I spoke, my hands moving dramatically with my words. "We're going to play now," I said, smiling. I was calm at the time, but in retrospect, I must have seemed kind of crazy. I was dimly aware of how things must have looked through their eyes. The precipitous ceiling fan and the bare light bulb, the couch with its rusty spring, the bizarre cherub carvings, the spinning shadows. I saw myself, wild-eyed and disheveled, shouting things in English, waving my arms in the air while holding a lit cigarette. The older girl, Reem, held a protective arm around her sister, Hanin, who looked like she was about to cry. I wanted to stop. Honestly, I did, but I couldn't. Their fear made me feel crazier. Is this what it feels like to be dangerous, I wondered. Well then, I was dangerous. I was Dracula, bizarrely accented creature of shadows. I was Shaitan, my apartment a trap for the unwary. I was Hindu, my gods many and many armed, my habits terrible. I was the darkness, the ugliest American, the lord of imports. I was the terrible Zionist vegetable. My glasses slipped down my nose. I pushed them back up with a talon. "I'll be right back," I said. "Don't move." The girls looked at each other in fear. I returned with the plastic bags from the corner store and placed them on the coffee table. "What's in the bags?" I asked them in English. They didn't respond. "What do you think is in the bags?" I asked again. In Arabic this time, pointing to one especially bulky bag. "Nothing." I cleared my throat and was all set to ask them again, when I realized that with each question, spittle was leaking from the corners of my mouth. I was foaming. The girls were trembling. This had to stop. I had to stop it. So I jumped up, took hold of the bulkiest bag, and turned it upside down. I'm going to skip to the second part of the story. This is another ploy to sell magazines or to make you use the internet. So I'm going to skip ahead past the scene with the girls, which you guys have been introduced to sort of the second part of the story, which is my meeting with the toughest man in Cairo. I have until 7:30, right? Yeah, 2 minutes. You'll have to drag me out of here. All right, so I'm just going to read from one, I guess, sort of the introduction to the toughest man in Cairo section so you get an idea of his character and what's going on there. So, Kamal never forgave me for what I did to his daughters. And there remained a part of me that wished things had ended on a more graceful note. After our mutual betrayal, our shared hallway continued to reverberate with ill feelings, and at any other time of my life, I might have dreaded leaving my apartment on the off chance I might encounter him or his family. But thanks to Kamal, I was a changed man. I was shameless. I wore shorts in the hallway and t-shirts in the street. I smoked a pack a day. I started drinking. And what's more, I was obsessed with Wagdi Lewis. One tale in particular fascinated me. Kamal and I had been driving from the airport to our apartment building. I was returning from a short visit to the United States and thought it very kind of him to make the hour-long drive on my behalf. When I came out of the terminal, luggage in hand, I looked around to find Kamal standing by his car, a gleam in his eyes and a pack of cigarettes in his hand. He had missed me. On the drive home, Kamal refused to open a window. I puffed and he vicariously inhaled until I grew dizzy, and Kamal, drunk off the smoke, began declaiming. "The toughest man in Cairo," he announced, and I knew what was coming. One time in the 1980s, Kamal told me as we pulled his rusty Fiat into a gas station, when Sadat was in power and everyone was being arrested all over again, the police tied Wagdi to a chair and beat him with their fists until the chair broke. Then they took the chair and tore the legs off and then beat him with the legs of the chair. I tried putting the cigarette in the car's ashtray. Kamal intercepted it and began waving it up and down in a chopping motion to demonstrate the violence of the torture. And after they broke the legs of the chair on his body, the police looked down at Wagdi Lewis, lying on the concrete floor of the police station in a pool of blood. There were splinters everywhere. They squatted down and yelled at him. "Are you ready to talk?" they yelled. And you know what happened? Kamal stopped and stared intently at me like I was one of the cops. His eyes were wide and distorted behind his thick lenses. Nothing. Nothing happened. He was asleep. Snoring. Kamal rolled down the window and tossed the cigarette onto the ground of the gas station. I cringed. "Now that's courage," he said. So, that's it.
Thank you. Those listening at home on the podcast, now would be an excellent time to have a snack or bake some cookies. Those of you here, please take just a very brief moment to quickly fill out those surveys before you rush out through those doors to join us for a glass of wine to toast our readers and publishers. Thanks for coming. See you next time.